This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We lost the godfather of soul this week, but we still have the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop. He's still in the game. He has a new CD called The Weirdness, scheduled to come out in March. But his influence on punk music has continued unabated for more than 35 years. Many of the punk bands of the 70s picked up on what Iggy Pop and his band The Stooges were doing in 1969. In 1977, music critic John Rockwell wrote, "Rock and roll is full of wild men toying with the limits of the possible or the permissible. In many ways, the farthest out of them all was Iggy Pop." Unquote. As for Iggy Pop's music, in 1970, music critic Robert Christgau wrote, "I regret all the times I've ever used words like power and energy to describe rock and roll, because this is what such rhetoric should have been saved for." Terry Gross spoke with Iggy Pop in 2005 when he released a 2-CD anthology of his music. It features his recordings with the Stooges, with whom he recently reunited, and also his solo work. It includes this now-famous song from the Stooges' first 1969 album, I Wanna Be Your Dog.
Iggy Pop, welcome to Fresh Air. Are those sleigh bells on the record?
Those are sleigh bells, the jazz instrument. You know, I was a drummer and percussionist before I was a vocalist. So, and I always liked jazz music, and so I was keen to use something to give the song a certain sense of space. Huh. And yeah, the sleigh bells sound, you know, they resound in a certain way, baby.
Now, you are now considered basically the godfather of punk. Did you think of yourself as being ahead of your time or just as like being different when you started to perform with the Stooges?
You better be different if you want to make any sort of lasting impression, I think. So there was, you know, there was some conscious effort to stand out. I didn't think there was a big future in sort of wearing a bowl haircut and a little polyester shirt and imitating the Yardbirds or something. So we were trying to do something fresh. And then the timeliness issue, that's tricky. And I still don't know what the real meaning of that phrase, it's ahead of your time, is. You know,
well, in this case, sure. I mean, the sound that you were creating was inspired
right.
A lot of other bands.
I would have to say the rest of the world was behind its effing time, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. We were, as far as I was concerned, where things should be in for us anyway. Given what talent we had to make the sounds, these were the sounds that were suggested to me by the architecture of the time, the ideas of the time, the social quakes of that time, things like that, and the musical history, the automotive design, all that suggested this music, and also a lot of this was the next logical step of the best current music being done at that time, as far as I was concerned.
Well, how did the ideas of the time shape the music in the sense that, you know, we're talking 1969, your first album, and, you know, for a lot of people, this is the era of, say, like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, or the Grateful Dead, or the Jefferson Airplane, right?
That was just all the phony, that was all phony as a $3 bill, really, and all those people were, they were talking one thing and living another. You know, these you must have noticed they all got fat really quickly physically, and there's a reason for that. It's visual. It was a visual sign of their incredible corruption. You know. And I mean, in the case of the airplane, they went all the way from White Rabbit to "We Built This City on Rock and Roll." It's just this crappy song, you know. But
you know, Iggy Pop is never going to get fat. No one's going to accuse you of being fat.
Well, you know, but there was all that going on, and basically, I think "Meet the New Boss," same as "The Old Boss," and "Won't Get Fooled Again" by Pete Townsend sums it up in a certain way. But there was a new bunch that was going to organize the disaffected youth and be a new group of leaders for us. And we came along. My band and I came along at just a couple years behind these people, and just thought, gee, do they suck? You know, to put it in an inarticulate, inchoate way, but to get more articulate about it, the musical goods were swinging less and less, and there was more and more artifice built without a good foundation, which is why it didn't really make you feel very good. It just sounded really impressive. And then the promises made weren't really going to be kept at any power level in the society. If I turned on the radio, if I turned on AM radio, I had to wait for 39 Leslie Gore songs to hear one good Beatles song, right? But, if I turned on the FM radio, I had to hear some guy who's, you know, acting really, you know, like really like he was a really cool guy, and we're going to play Mr. Fantasy again by Traffic, you know. Dig the flute on this, you know. And it was just so awful and boring, and, you know, you had this crappy, oh, and then everybody jumped on the bandwagon. So you had this pathetic song by a group called the Chambers Brothers, who were, you know, a likable black singing group who decided, we got to get in on this psychedelic thing. So they had a song called "The Time," and it was, you know, "My mind has been psychedelicized," and it's just a lot of, you know, crap. And then professional songwriters, of course, who not to be left behind in the Brill Building, you know, the same guys who used to write "It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To," then they had to get in on the act, and they're writing songs like "My Green Tambourine," which you can play on the thing if you want, on this show if you want to illustrate my point, you know.
Iggy Pop speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Iggy Pop, the godfather of punk.
One of the things you've done on stage is dive into the audience. Which I think a lot of other people copied over the years.
Yeah, the first time I did that, it was just I was opening for the Mothers of Invention. It was the second show we'd ever played. I'd played with the Stooges. It was the first one I did as a front vocalist. I had set down the guitar and I was, you know, just front the band, and I was terrified, and I was looking for a way to get a certain kind of attention and make something happen. There was a gap between myself and the audience, a physical gap. It was too wide, and I wanted it to close. And there were only a couple of girls came and got very near the stage, but that was it. No other takers. So I thought, well, it'd be cool if I fell on them. And I did what little kids do. I don't know if you got kids, but they go through a phase, I think they're about 3 or 4, maybe 5 or 6, where they'll stand very rigid and sort of mime falling on the floor,
mm-hmm.
falling on their face. I did that. And they didn't catch me. So I chipped a tooth pretty badly on that gig. But that began some of my fascination with crossing the proscenium. It wasn't long after that I had a pair of jeans that I really, really liked, and I didn't want to stop wearing them at gigs, and they started getting rips and slits and holes, and nobody else was doing that either. Nobody even walked on the street with holes in their pants, and now I see every little hairdresser in L.A. walking around with slit-up pants and Michael Jackson, and it's incredible. I got that, basically that fashion from, it was a reverse of what R&B singers used to do. P.J. Proby was famous for this. They would wear pants that were very, very thin and lightly basted instead of well sewn, and they go out on stage, and when they do an acrobatic split or something, the pants would rip open, and it was supposed to be a sexually charged event in the show. So I just thought, well, why not just come out with them already ripped? let's just drop the ceremony here, you know.
You hardly
come
came out
with a ripped pants, you know.
You've come out with hardly any clothes to begin with. I mean, you rarely wear anything on your chest. You're usually like bare chested.
They all say something. Everything you wear says something. And I just felt that what everything was saying was getting in the way. If you wear a T-shirt that says "Free Katie Holmes," you're saying something. Yeah, you know? You wear a blue Oxford shirt, you're saying something.
But of course, if you're bare chested, you're saying something too. You can't get away.
It can mean a lot of things. It can mean a lot of things. It's a little more basic. I got a lot of ideas for the Stooges in the undergrad library of the University of Michigan. I still had my library card. I was a college dropout, and I thought, well, this is going to take some thought, there are a lot of good books in here. I used to go there and read a lot of Social Ant, which gave me a lot of ideas about behavior, tribal behavior, and its possible application to rock shows. But I was also just looking at a book of Egyptian antiquity one day, and all the pharaohs never wear shirts. And I just kept looking, and I thought, gee, there's something about that. There's something expressive. And now, it's not going to work, if you're a big fat guy with a hairy chest, then that's different. But if you have I was lucky enough. I had a sort of a basically normal, I thought, hey, I can do Pharaoh. Yeah,
But you have a very interesting body. I mean, like your arms, at least nowadays, it looks like you've been working out. Your arms look pretty pumped up. But your chest is like so thin and always has been. And so you see like every rib and sometimes even like blood vessels you can see.
Yeah, funny boy.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like it's an interesting and very skinny body.
I don't pump, by the way.
You don't?
No,
how'd you get
the
muscles?
Record, I do something. I like to go swimming a lot,
uh-huh.
And I have a lot of sex, and I do something related to Tai Chi called Qigong.
Why don't we hear another track from the anthology? And I thought we could play something from Raw Power. And there's two things I can't make up my mind between these two, so I'm going to let you decide. We can either hear Give Me Danger or Raw Power. What do you think?
I would take Give Me Danger.
Okay. And why are you choosing it?
It's a little more musically complex.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about writing
just
it?
Just as a muso, I just like that one a little better. The conceit in the title was just taken from the Stones had a song called Gimme Shelter, and the theme of the song being, there are all sorts of turbulent and dangerous things going on, and maybe some – existential loneliness and angst of the modern hero, that sort of thing. And I was looking at the life that myself and my band at that time were barely leading, and I thought, basically, we're looking for trouble and we've got it. And I understood that, but I thought I could forestall the ticking of the clock long enough to make a nice work of art. So basically this song fit into that. That was the general theme of that album, was being Raw Power, was being in the service of some very basic and powerful forces to your eventual detriment, and you know, it's leading in a very destructive direction eventually. And then this particular one is about basically it's saying in a very elaborate way, I go for really bad chicks. That's the basic thing of the song. You know? So it's okay. Hey, if you're a really bad chick, you know, that's you're probably my type, baby. That's the deal.
So when you say "and I'll feel your disease," are you referring to VD?
Well, no, not necessarily. Okay. Just whatever
you got.
Whatever's wrong. Whatever's okay. Wrong. Yeah. You're in danger, little stranger, and I'll feel you up here. Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll feel your disease. There's nothing in my dreams, just some ugly memories. Kiss me like the ocean breeze. Hey!
You were saying before we heard that you and your band at the time were looking for trouble and finding it. You talked about being under the sway of powerful forces. Were you talking at all there about drugs?
Well, yeah, the drugs came into it as, but they're really, those are enablers of deeper things, usually. So basically, we were a bunch of guys who, somewhere along the line, in one way or another, each of us, what we had in common was each of us had put a foot out of line and we weren't going along with the quote-unquote the program. But I thought what it really did, the really pronounced effect it had on me, all of them had in common, was to shut out all sorts of things. And that kind of was really helpful at certain times when you're trying to make something creative. There are all sorts of voices within and without you that are going to say, no, it's not worth doing. No, it will never get finished correctly. No, it's no good. No, nobody will like it. No, it's not worth thinking about. No, it would be more fun or more profitable to go do X, Y, and Z instead of sticking on plan A, that sort of thing. Drugs were pretty good for shutting out a lot of the naysay in existence, at least for me, for a while. And then basically my experience was that little by little they rocked and socked my nervous system too much to be worth the trouble. And then finally, and very quickly after that, I don't know, as a tide recedes late in the day, all the possible positives just seem to disappear and you're just left with the hideous negatives.
Right.
That's kind of how it went for me.
And you did the
whole thing. You're sort of like, I could compare it, if I could compare my body to a neighborhood, a really nice neighborhood that everybody suddenly becomes popular and it quickly becomes overdeveloped. That's sort of like, basically, the drugs begin to build condos all over your body until you don't want to live there anymore. Kind of like that, you know?
Iggy Pop speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Iggy Pop, the godfather of punk.
Do you think of Iggy Pop as being like a stage persona, and are you still Jim Osterberg offstage?
Well, that used to be the case, but not anymore, because I've been Iggy Pop longer than I was just Jim Osterberg.
Mm-hmm.
So things have changed. It's been, I started being me when I was, I don't know how many years old, 21, something like that. And that was 37 years ago. So I was only without me for about 20 years.
Was that how you felt when you created, like, Iggy Pop, that you had figured out who you really were, that was who you really
no,
were?
No, it was just like I gained the services of an extra person, actually. You know, it's, as Iggy Pop, there are all sorts of things I can do and receive and be that were not happening for Jim Osterberg. And then I have a great deal of pleasure being Jim Osterberg, and I have just a really lovely private existence that way. And Iggy does a lot for me.
What does Iggy do for you?
Well, he pays, for one thing.
And
very well, I might add. He saves me all sorts of social necessities, you know, because he's known. He gets me a good table.
In the 70s and in the 80s, did you expect that you were going to die young?
No. No. I never even, I don't know about you, but you don't think about those sort of thing until you hit 50-something, you know, and then little voice starts saying, hey, guess what? Guess what? You know what the next phase is, don't you? That's right. Ciao, bunny bunny. What are you going to do with the time anyway? Sort of thing.
Well, if you're hearing that voice, is that changing anything for you?
Yeah, you think about all sorts of things. It makes you a little more mellow about some of the little everyday human encounters. A little more, not much. And then otherwise probably makes a little more careful. And other than that, it's sort of like if I looked at the arc of my life emotionally, I'd say that the last part's starting to resemble the first part. In that the first 7 years, I feel that I'm in the seventh 7 year cycle of my profession. I am professionally in that. I thought about this the other day. I started in the early mid 60s. I got my union card, and pretty much my life's gone in 7 year cycles, and this is the seventh now. I'm about a year into it, and this is the last one. When I finish this one, I'll be 65, and that's that's about as old as you can get, and not be forced to kind of shift your, you have to shift your professional outlook, I think, to second base at that point. But right now, I'm still a loaded gun, and on the first seven and the last seven, each seem to be based on a lot of thought about, okay, what do I really want to do here, and how can I do it to the best of my ability, and then of course, how can I fend off anybody who isn't going along with that?
Now,
which involves just all sorts of buddies.
Now that you have this,
then of course you enjoy support. I get a lot more support now than I did during the first 7 years, which is great because when you're an old git, you need it. So I've got money now that I need money. You know, I'll have a little bit of, you know, a little bit of attention. I need it. You know, because it's harder to break through the papier-mâché at this point.
Terry Gross spoke with Iggy Pop last year. He's working on a new CD, which is expected out in March. Fresh Air was produced and edited this year by Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Sharrock, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar, with Sue Spolin, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Mike and Scott, and Lauren Krenzel. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineers are Julian Hirschfeld, Audrey Bentham, and Joyce Lieberman. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming. For my fellow guest host Dave Davies, and for Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. We'll go out with Jimi Hendrix playing this New Year's Eve classic at the Fillmore East in 1969. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a very happy New Year.